Hallo, ihr hört das Freifunkradio hier aus der Raumfahrtagentur in Berlin-Wedding. Heute zu Gast haben wir Adam, ein Internet-Urgestein, und wir werden auf Englisch sprechen.
Welcome, Adam.
Welcome, Adam.
Hi, thanks guys for inviting me back.
Yeah, a second time that you're in our broadcast.
Indeed, yeah.
It's lovely that you came again.
Yeah. Last time we talked about the Internet Governance Forum. Was it called like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's right. The United Nations holds an event called the Internet Governance Forum once a year. It tours the world in different cities, and last year it was in Berlin. And we held a couple of sessions. One was directly related to Freifunk, and we talked about Elektra's advances and Freifunk's activities in bringing people in the edge that are hidden into view in terms of electronic communications, specifically at the Tempelhofer Feld, where refugees at the time were being housed in the hangars, and Freifunk installed Wi-Fi access points in order to help them communicate to the outside world. This was just one of the many examples of Freifunk joining and bridging communities, where you have a recreational park on the one hand, where people are jogging, kite flying, and so on within the centre of Berlin. At the same time, there was a hidden community out of sight in a hangar, needing communication to the outside world beyond feeling as though they were staying in almost like a recreational zoo. That was part of the presentation that we gave at the IGF conference. And the second part, the second presentation that we're involved in, was called the Internet Commons Forum, where we started to question and examine the human requirements of networking and communications in the modern age, and whether the modern internet is fit for purpose in a variety of fields, from internet governance and the bodies that currently govern them, to UI design and platform, to communication networks that are being built on the edge of the network, including community wireless networks such as Freifunk, but not exclusive to that, discussing other initiatives globally, and to try and come to terms with a modern aspect of what we actually really need from a communication system and how we go about achieving it. Throwing aside old assumptions. So we had people dealing with UI design of applications, as well as disintermediation. So we had people developing programs that allow communications to occur independent of mobile phone providers, independent of the internet itself. So we had Matthias Judd, who develops a system called Call.net, which allows peer-to-peer communications to occur on mobile phones, one mobile phone to the next, in a mesh network that allows passing of communications from one mobile phone to the next, to the next, to the next. Again, independent of a Wi-Fi access point or of mobile phone GSM networks. So a truly independent network. So how do we look at the communications of the future, and how does it impact us? So that was a brief summary of our last talk.
Yeah, indeed.
I think we add a link to the last show, to our show notes, and people interested can listen to the whole show again.
Yeah, it was the December show.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but apart from taking part in the Internet Forum, you have been active in many things. You told me, if I remember correctly, you were involved in starting the first internet service provider in New Zealand, or the second?
Australia. And first. Yeah, although there's always dispute about the first. In fact, a later show may mention someone who claims first in terms of internet service provision in Australia as well. However, I was involved in internet service provision in the early days in Australia, and we had, as far as possible, national coverage. So that involved a gateway to the national provider that provided dial-up services at very low speeds compared to today, provided national dial-up facilities at the time, and we had a gateway into their services and a few other gateways into local regional services internationally into Southeast Asia and into Pacific Islands.
What year are we talking?
Oh, shit, we're talking ancient history here, okay. Early mid-90s, so from 1992 onwards, which is a world away from where we are now.
In the digital world it is, yeah.
Yeah, in a very naive day. And one of the things I like to say is that a lot of people see those times and think that there was a lot of idealism and perhaps even naivety. But I'd also like to remind those people that the internet and digital communications isn't what it was then. You know, the growth of the large tech giants that we have now was not there. We'd just experienced the fall of previous tech communication giants such as AOL and CompuServe, to name just a few. And we were looking forward to the bright new future there, and all I can say is we're looking to the bright new future in the near future, when the relevance of the existing tech giants fades into the background.
You're looking forward to that, obviously.
I think so. No, I really do, because I think in the diversity allows for new areas of human freedom and of optimism. And, yeah.
The problem I see is that the typical issue of network effects. Once a network or a communication system or a company like Google has grown so far to have so many users, it's incredibly hard to establish new kids on the block.
Yeah, I think you're right too. And part of the corporate dominance of the modern internet is probably due to its success as it became more and more popular and ubiquitous. The centralization started to happen again. And in mathematics, this is often described as something along the lines of the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. As things get to a certain size, emergent properties start to take hold in terms of monopolies or central players within a system. You know, and it's often thought that this starts to happen in a sort of 80-20%. 80% of the people will follow along certain lines of services or things available, and there'll be a 20% outlier in this as well. It's sort of interesting, and it tends to happen in a lot of other systems as well, from the biological to the economic. And we'll see, but I'm hopeful that our current system is not likely to continue for too much longer, and I'm hopeful that you know, our generation can contribute to a new system or a new complement to what we already have that will help change this environment.
Well, I guess the tech companies are afraid that yet again a small group of two or three people come up with a brilliant idea that is pervasive and will massively change the business and the things, how things work, as it happened previously with the people that started, Twitter, Facebook, Google, or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me help you with seeding such inspirational ideas.
Please, go ahead.
You know, it's my small observation that we started with a client-server aspect of a mainframe and a user, and so we started off thinking of ourselves as people who sit in front of a terminal that get closer to a computing core. And you know, fast forward a little closer to today, you know, we all, many, many people anyway, have laptops, computers themselves that far outweigh the power of, you know, mainframe computers of that time. This is good. This is all natural, you know, progression and so on. But we have this. But further to that, you know, around our person, we have a network of devices. We might have one, some people even more than one, other network devices, mobile phones, and so on. So all of a sudden, we find ourselves as an owner of a network. You know, so all of a sudden, we start to wonder about, well, this is our network. What do we do with it? And how do we protect it? You know, so we all start to worry about network security at a personal level. Well, in this new world, and one thing I would like to start people to think about is that the next level is that perhaps personally we should start to think about ourselves being the equivalent of a data center. Now, a data center is a vital component within the central core internet as we know it. You know, there are regional data centers in most developed countries that provide a service. They provide a space, a sovereignty, and a set of facilities that allow you to communicate. They often contain thousands of individual computers and perhaps just as many virtual or real local networks within their facility. We are starting to find ourselves in a position where we, our neighbors, our friends, our families, out at the edge of the current modern network, can start to think about how we could provide a similar service amongst people that we either know personally or perhaps we directly trust. So this is like the philosophy of free networking expanded to the concept of a data center, rather than just a network or an access network to the larger internet. And this is, I find, a fascinating concept, because we can start to redefine what we see as the edge and the core of a network. If 100 Raspberry Pi embedded computers can take place and replace the reliability and the accessibility of a central core, then we're looking at very much the situation that we saw in the 80s and the 90s, where local services can provide most of what you want and need, except for when you need to, say, dial internationally or dial further away. Do you see what I'm saying? So local provisioning of services can start to be held in an autonomous way, closer to people, closer to a social circumstance than they are when they are provided within the environment of a platform in a traditional data center environment. So this is very much an advocacy for peer-to-peer networking or systems that allow for such operations. And when you need to communicate further away, you use facilities that are available to you at the time.
The problem that I see, I'm afraid, in our Freifunk networks, we hardly see the emergence of strong local services.
Yeah.
Because what we have in our network is just a little tiny subset of what is available globally.
This is because, to a large degree, the centralized services, from the governance to the implementation of the fabric services, so services such as DNS, that's domain names system, IP allocation, and other things, prohibit the direct or propagation of the ubiquity of services. Added to the fact that a lot of standards for the alternate standards for the discovery of such services are very fragmented.
It's exactly the problem.
Yeah,
for example,
yeah.
I run my own server since 20 years probably by now, and I host my own videos, I host some music that I played, recordings that we upload to radio.freifunk.net.
Mm-hmm.
Before we publish them, I publish them there, so Andy picks it up there, but there's hardly any traffic.
Yeah.
You know, if I want to have range with the stuff that I'm producing, if I upload it to SoundCloud, I probably have more people using the data. They're probably not so much interested in my person, but the platform makes it easier for people to access. At least that's where they are looking for content today.
Yeah, so that relationship, I would argue, is flawed. So that if you want the maximum number of people to reach you, then you're not interested in locality and you're not interested in the strength of local bonds, okay? So the aims there really are to emulate the old forms of media in terms of centralized broadcast media in a personal sense. Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Put yourself out there and see who comes back. In the same way, the modern internet, as we know it, with all the undersea cables and the infrastructure, allows people from other countries, halfway around the world even, Australia even, give a chance to listen to your musical playlist or be exposed to your content, which is absolutely fine. The issues that I guess I'm talking about are more the value of other connections, the connections of your everyday life that are closer to you. So to try and bring the context of individual human beings back to networking, the remote ones are of value as well, but I think there is a hidden human value in locality, in meaning in that sense, and I think that local aggregation of autonomous units at the edge can start to eat away at the importance of globally ubiquitous services. We can start to recreate our own cultures, not only in just a geographical sense, but I think there is something in that, but also from the strength of that aggregation, then network internationally or to the next city as required. So to bring back human values, we are, after all, animals. We can be in one place at any one time, and we can travel either by foot or by plane with more carbon footprints.
Yes, of course.
But yeah, you know, so I think these issues should be considered in at least experimenting with other models.
We're looking for the killer application that makes it attractive to use the Freifunk network other than just using it as a mere uplink to the internet.
Okay.
Which is what most people are actually looking for.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry if I am the devil's advocate.
Please do be.
In this communication. You know, if we are talking about local content, your content can be available to the world if anyone outside is interested.
Mm-hmm.
And by the mere looking up the GPS data, you can only see services that are in your close proximity. So if you artificially limit the range of what you're seeing, you can do it from the perspective of a global interconnected network that has all the data and limited to your close proximity, rather than having a service that only reaches only so and so far. And we're always looking for the killer application that makes it highly attractive to just have a network where that is limited to the local users, that inspires people to join the network just for that. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. I would like to make the proposition that the networking should not be related so much to geolocational space, but to the space of human relationships. So to take back the issue of trust, which has always been a problematic issue when you start to talk about trust and machines or trust and external entities. Trust, I think, is intrinsically a human property. If you give trust in something, in the end, I would hope at least, you would hope that you give trust in another human being or another group of other human beings, and everything in between is a mediation. So what I'm interested in suggesting is keeping that human-to-human connection in that sense. And also, yes, I'm starting to work on some potential solutions to that. I've started to embark on what we have called the Homunculus Project.
How did you come to that name?
It had absolutely nothing to do with you, Electra. Actually, it did. It had a lot to do with you. It had a lot to do with our prior discussions around consciousness and
the homunculus in the prefrontal lobe of the cortex.
Yeah, indeed. The myth of the Cartesian theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what we're talking about in this instance is more homunculus in terms of machines and digital identities, where you can start to explore social relationships in a more direct way, and also to part of it also is a facility and a tool to allow you to start to generate machines virally, in other words, whether they're virtual computers, real computers, containerized computers, and any other modern variant, but to allow the viral spread, the new viral spread of resources around you and around your friends and other people.
Well, that's typically not what a virus does. Oh, of course, there are viruses that take other people's resources and abuse them.
Yeah, but I mean viruses in particular, I'm comparing them to the biological equivalents, so that if you're infected and get on a plane, you can infect people a long way away. So this is what I'm talking about, the difference between locality in terms of like a community wireless network is constrained by the physical distance allowed by the radio communication. Yeah, exactly. Whereas I'm talking more about the range of direct human relationships and how they spread, no matter where they are in the world.
We've got only 5 minutes to go.
And we still don't know what to talk about.
Time flies.
Like time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana.
Can you, before we started the broadcast, you had your definition of time. Can you please elaborate that again?
Oh yeah, sure.
Your definition of time.
It's a wonderful thing, and I'm not sure who to attribute. The last quote was Groucho Marx, of course, but this quote, and I've forgotten who said it. I think it was a physicist, but he asks the question, what is time for? And the answer is, of course, time stops everything from happening at once. And it's a lovely answer. I mean, I really like that. That's what it's for. Otherwise, everything would be boring and over before you knew it. So we still have stories to tell. We still have songs to sing. That's why time is here.
Well, it's, of course, slightly off topic of our general aim of this podcast, but of course I like quotes like this.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I'm not really sure I got you right on that homunculus thing. Could you use the last 3.5 minutes to...
3.5 minutes. Okay. The homunculus project comes from, in technical terms, we're starting to consider two projects developed by an associate, a colleague of mine, who heads up and founded and headed up an organization called dyne.org. And the two projects are DAOs and their newer project called Zen Room. This is the combination of a project that allows visibility of Wi-Fi Internet of Things, together with a new crypto library that will allow generation of digital identities and cryptographic material to complement this, which means we can finally move from the world of things on a network to start to think about digital identities of people behind the things. And the visualization of that fascinates me. In other words, bringing visualization of relationships of human entities and social interactions, at least in a limited sense, becomes possible, and I would like to play with that in the future.
How is it different to people that are analyzing, for example, the relationships between Twitter accounts on social media, for example?
This is indirectly mediated by a centralized platform such as Twitter. What I'm talking about here is more direct liaisons. So, for instance, in a simple Freifunk sense, if you want to gain access to a Wi-Fi network run by your friends, then you would present them your digital identity. By whatever verification means you like, you can then directly start to engage. You might have a default set of permissions for someone you don't know, and then as you get to know them in one form or another, you can change that to being a close friend, which may allow access to other facilities and so on.
So a network of social trust?
Of unmediated social trust, yes. Of decentralized social trust. So you don't need the platform of Twitter, of OpenID, of any other system to mediate this relationship that you start to form. It's mediated in a digital sense, of course, but beyond that, you know, you've got to be face-to-face.
Yeah, so that's the last 30 seconds. I think we have to elaborate a little bit more on that on another occasion.
We'll have to wait till next time.
So thanks, everyone, for listening. We actually have to stop our broadcast now to make space for the others.
Thanks, Adam, for being our guest.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for coming. Thank you for allowing me to speak my madness.
Of course.